Hi, and welcome to our fourth Radio Medical Podcast with Dr. Larry Robbins and my co-host, Susie Robbins, who is a social worker, mom, and my wife. We have a number of interesting topics today, and as you know from the first three segments podcasts, we tend to go with the flow and go where it takes us. I try to hit cutting-edge topics that people are generally interested in, and answer emails that people are interested in. First topic up today is there was an interesting article this week on drug use up for boomers and down for teens. They looked at almost 70,000 people and concluded that in any given month, almost 20 million Americans use illegal drugs. Now, about 120 million people drink, but alcohol is legal. The last time I looked, it's not prohibition. But 20 million Americans using illegal drugs, and a lot of those are age 50 to 60, the baby boomers. We always think of drug use as 15 to 20 to 30, but lo and behold, it turns out that a lot of us elderly, actually boomers, are using illegal drugs. And of course, by illegal drugs, we mean THC, marijuana, ecstasy and illegal pills, GHB, etc., etc., MMDA, and the good old standbys, cocaine and methamphetamine. And then there's a scattering of other drugs such as LSD and heroin, etc., etc. Incredibly, what I see is some parents actually do drugs with our kids, more smoking dope, but sometimes other drugs as well. And at the very least, a lot of parents don't frown on it with our kids. They figure that, well, if the kids do it with their friends just in their basement, at least they're safe and they're okay. And they don't draw their line in the sand and don't give their kids a hard time about it. I wanted to ask my co-host Susie, what do you think about that?
Well, to me, it sounds kind of shocking. I wonder if it surprises the parents when, after encouraging their kids or at least allowing them to do the drugs, how they feel when their kids have to go into rehab.
Now, Susie, you did have experience in a couple of high schools with kids at risk or who were into drugs. What was that like?
Well, you know, I think what stands out, what I remember most clearly is that for so many kids who were smoking just marijuana, I don't mean just marijuana as meaning just the mere presence of marijuana, but that was exclusively what they were doing, is that they really felt that it was okay to do it, that it was not a strong drug, it wasn't going to hurt them.
Didn't they always just say, oh, it's only weed, it's not really a drug?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that it was actually natural, it was grown in the ground, how can it hurt us? But I would hope that a lot of those kids down the road who did continue to smoke and stayed with it realized that what it did do was take away their desire to pursue education and other things.
Now, outside of dope, was alcohol the main drug in the kids, or were they doing pills or coke at that point?
Well, I think in any high school, you're going to see a mixture of all of those, all of the drugs and the alcohol. But certainly alcohol was, and to my understanding, still is probably the largest drug of choice for teenagers.
Now, according to this new study, a lot of the parents are getting high on various things, and certainly it doesn't give a great precedent for the kids. I think that the take-home lesson is don't do drugs, but that was sort of a failed message in the 80s, that parents, even if they are doing things, I'd rather have them not, but they should not do it with their kids. And I think that there's a crucial message to give to kids that we're not, even though we know we can't always control certain use of smoking marijuana, for instance, but at least we're not encouraging it, and we do frown upon it. Because I think in the kids, the back of their mind, they may not acknowledge it, but what their parents, whether their parents are accepting of it or not does matter. Susie, any thoughts?
Well, I agree with you. What it brings to mind for me is my own experiences growing up is how many parents actually smoke cigarettes in that generation, and how many of the kids who lived with smoking parents ended up also smoking because it was accessible, it was in the house, and, you know, they followed their parents in them doing it.
Yeah, that brings up a good point. We don't remember, you know, now it seems weird to have teenagers and parents smoking cigarettes in the house, but it was common back there in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s to have teenage kids or kids as young as age 11, 12 lighting up. The parents, you know, everybody was smoked. It was like a haze of blue smoke in the living room.
That reminds me of actually last night we were at a party where probably the majority of people were smoking, which was, I think in this day and age, seems a little odd, and that the parents who were giving the party, their daughter who was in her mid-20s was also smoking. And you just don't see that like you used to.
Not as much. But still, 29% of Americans use tobacco one way or another. Usually it's cigarettes, but they're cigars and pipes. You don't see many pipes out there. I used to smoke pipes way back when. But nobody liked them, and everybody screamed at you, so I stopped smoking them. But they were sort of cool. You had all this stuff to do with a pipe and everything. But there's also smokeless snuff, et cetera, et cetera. But 29% of Americans using tobacco is still a fair amount, although it goes down each year, which is the good news. I have to admit, in my patients who've had addictions, I'll have alcoholics, and they'll say they can quit alcohol, but darn it if they can't quit smoking. I think it's the toughest addiction in the end. Susie, what do you think?
Well, speaking from experience, I would definitely agree with you. I was one of those kids that grew up in a home where the parents did smoke, and I did pick up the habit early in my mid-teens, and I smoked for years after that. At some point, though, in my late 30s, I really wanted to quit, but I felt that I couldn't do it on my own. I had tried a few times, but never successfully. So what I did was actually enroll in a smoking cessation program at a local hospital. And I think there were 12 of us in that program, and I was successful in quitting then. But I remember it was just myself and one other person that actually completed the program.
You know, it's the old adage, it's easy to quit smoking. I've done it many times. Each attempt to quit smoking only has about a 4% long-term success rate by people. But the more times they try, the better. And combining things, the smoking cessation program that you were in, I think that was great. Combining it with maybe nicotine products, the inhaler or the patch or the gum, and sometimes medicine, such as Wellbutrin, Zyban. Wellbutrin is the same as Zyban for smoking. There's also a couple newer products. But whatever we use, I think that combining things sometimes helps. But I tell patients all the time, if it took a voodoo doctor, I would use it for stopping smoking. It's the toughest. Susie?
I agree with everything you're saying. However, I still do believe that even with all of the aids that we have now to quit, you really have to be ready mentally and emotionally yourself to quit, because it's not going to happen without your real desire to see it happen.
It's a tough, tough thing. Now, I wanted to segue into a couple of interesting emails that we got last week. One is, the gist of it is, do you have any tips on losing weight? Interestingly enough, there was an article this week on fast food eaters underestimating calories. And I think the studies have shown that our proportion size, particularly in fast food, has grown by at least a third in the last 25 years. We have the big gulps and we have the huge portions and everybody's eating a lot more. And I saw a study last week that was interesting too, where they even had nutrition dietitians eating out of a larger bowl than out of a smaller bowl. And it's a psychological thing. People, eating out of a smaller bowl always will eat less. But the nutritionists, dietitians thought that they were eating the same amount out of the larger bowl, but it turned out to be 25% more. So one idea, particularly in the morning with cereal, etc., is to grab a smaller bowl. You know, as far as losing weight, interestingly enough, there was a study, it's an ongoing study out of a university, where they asked people who've kept weight off for at least 5 years. So we're talking about long term, not 3 months, not a month, not 6 months. Long-term weight loss. They asked, now this is over 5,000 people, I think they're up to almost 6,000 now, what are your secrets? What do you do? And it turns out that almost everybody does the same thing who've kept weight off long-term. First of all, none of them diet, so throw out the diets. Although I do like, it's not really a diet, but Weight Watchers, I've always found long-term to be the most successful program. They all exercised a lot. They averaged 50 minutes of exercise, although we'll take even 10 minutes twice a day. Treadmill, bike, walking, anything that people like to do. It's the boredom of exercise that gets to people. So exercise is a key long term. Everybody falls off the wagon here and there with weight loss, with exercise. The idea is to just get right back on the wagon the next day. But everybody in the who has long-term weight loss tends to exercise. They graze throughout the day with small meals. Portion control is crucial. Not putting as much on the plate, not taking seconds and thirds, and eating off of everybody else's plate, which is one of my problems. I've always eaten off of everybody else's plate, and when I'm gaining weight, I'll go up and down. I'm eating everybody else's food too. Counting calories. Weight Watchers, they count points sometimes, but you have to have some idea of how many calories. So there's a lot of good books out there on calories. And the problem really is people who are always thin, they hit middle life where we thicken up, and they don't know how many calories is in everything. Those of us who've battled weight a lot of our lives often tended to learn about the calories early and learn how much is in everything. Weigh yourself often. A lot of people who have long-term weight loss weigh themselves every day, and they generally found themselves on a low-fat eating regimen as opposed to carbs or something like that. So low-fat was the most preferred diet of choice, or not diet, but what people ate for long-term weight loss. And I can't emphasize this enough. Don't diet. Don't think, well, I have to lose 30 pounds in the next month. Reasonable goals are always crucial, and Weight Watchers always is good about setting reasonable goals. If you're 190 pounds and you want to get to 165, if you say, well, I need to be 165 or 130, you're not going to get there. It's too daunting. It's too discouraging. You set 5 pounds as a weight loss and give yourself a reasonable amount of time. With weight loss, I think the slow turtle gets there. The fast hare gains the weight right back. So you want to be a turtle about it. Now we're climbing into the full thrust of middle age. Susie, what do you think about exercise, weight loss, and how to go about it?
Well, I wish I could report some really good tricks on how I've handled it. But it's hard. I think for most of us, as we've hit and are certainly cruising in middle age, we have to figure out what works best for us. I do recall, as I mentioned earlier in the program, when I quit cigarettes about 12 years ago or so, I did see for a short period of time a little bit of a weight increase. But I think that has evened out now. But I am one of those people who didn't really have to count calories until I hit middle age. And then it was like, oh, I guess I can't have that milkshake today because it's going to make a difference. I'm not going to feel as comfortable in my jeans tomorrow. One thing that I've started doing in the last year, which I love, is called Strength Club. And it is done in a gym, in a Strength Club gym, where we use Nautilus equipment, moving the weights very, very slowly. It's about a 30-minute workout. You probably hit 8 or 9 machines, and it's not so much the burning the calories is as really strengthening up your muscles and bones. About 6 months ago, I found out that I have pre-osteoporosis. And as I'm sure a lot of listeners out there know, that weights is one of the ways we can combat that. So I started doing this strength club, and it's just been wonderful.
Yeah, to prevent long-term bone loss, weight-bearing exercises, weightlifting is very helpful. And they used to call that super slow, I believe it, where instead of our usual fairly quick biceps, triceps, curls, etc., you would do it a very, very slow one repetition in, what is it, half a minute, a minute?
Well, actually, you want to work up to about 2 minutes. But because you're doing it so slowly, you're not using any you're not allowing momentum to take over. You're actually pushing the weight just with your muscle. And part of their philosophy is that if you can no longer push it, you'd rather stop than to lose your form.
And I see people with that build up, if they want to build bulk, really they build up musculature pretty quickly. The nice thing about weightlifting, however people do it, is it's immediately reinforcing. People see the difference, they feel it, they see it in the mirror, they feel it, they feel the firmness. And I think that can help because then it's motivating to keep going. Another program that people have liked, a lot of women like Curves. It's half an hour. There's no men in there, so they don't have to be worried about being embarrassed or anything. You can go in your street clothes. And so Curves seems to have worked out. However, people can get it into their lives. If they get things at home, treadmill, bike, etc., etc. Bikes are nice because you can read on the bike. It's the boredom of exercise, which is why people stop in general. They lose motivation. And the health clubs are nice because a lot of times now at the health clubs, each particular bike, treadmill, etc. has their own TV and can keep people interested or reading. However people want it. Susie, what do you think?
Well, I think for many people, health clubs are the way to go. But I think for as many people as who like health clubs, there's a lot of people, I think I'm in that population, who would prefer not to go to a health club if they could. They'd rather have a piece of equipment at home or do something more on their own.
Yeah, or both. Getting a headset for walking outside, having stuff at home. The problem with health clubs, they tend to be expensive. People don't use the membership, and then they get discouraged and they quit. Or they start out and they're going 3 times a week, and then after 6 months, forget it. Now, I wanted to talk about another email that we had from a listener about hormones and headaches. And the question was birth control pills and headaches. Actually, there's a lot of hormonal issues with headaches. Menstrual migraines tend to be the most severe and long-lasting. They're the toughest to get at. We have to throw more medicine at the menstrual migraines in general. Menopause and headache tends to be a big issue. And the birth control pill, of course. A lot of women do worse on the birth control pill, and studies have shown that the more estrogen women take, either in menopause or with a birth control pill, the more headaches they get. But sometimes it actually helps headaches. Susie, do you think the birth control pill might have helped your migraines?
To the contrary, I think it contributed to my migraines quite a bit. In fact, I think that's what actually was the beginning of my migraine career, is when I started taking the pill about 12 years ago.
Sometimes I think that if we don't cycle the birth control pill, it's better, where we don't have a menstrual period for 3 or 4 or 5 months. It's actually not dangerous not to have a menstrual period. And some women with severe 3, 4, 5 day terrible menstrual migraines don't cycle it. They stay on the active birth control pill for 3, 4, 5 months and have less periods and less headaches. And then as we get into menopause, we tend to stop the birth control pill, of course, and some women go on estrogen. The whole pendulum with estrogen swings back and forth. Everybody's supposed to have it, then nobody's supposed to have it. Now it's back in the middle, it seems, where we're just using it judiciously. Susie, with your headaches, what's your experience been as time has gone on?
Well, recently, in the last few months, I have actually stopped taking the birth control pill, and my migraines have pretty much ceased, which has been wonderful. However, as I think a lot of women can relate with this, I'm now at a point in my life where I'm trying to figure out for myself, do I want to go on estrogen or not? And I still have not made my mind up on that.
You know, there's a lot of downsides to estrogen. There's a lot of upsides. And I think the studies aren't completely in as far as some of the downsides and upsides. We'll talk about that in a future program. Generally, headaches tend to get better as we get on into menopause and menstrual periods have ceased for a while. But in the early stages of menopause, sometimes they're worse. But certainly the hormonal headaches, which are the most severe, tend to cease afterwards. And headaches often get better in the 50s and 60s for other reasons, too. The arteries don't get big and small as easily around the head. They're not as elastic. There might be serotonin changes in the brain. So a lot of people's headaches are better. But I still do have probably about 7 to 8% of the world at age 70, 80, 90 have headaches that are a problem. So migraines and bad tension headaches can continue, unfortunately. Or they can even start at age 70 or 80. You know, another issue as we get into menopause or into the 50s, say, is what do we use for the headaches? How do we treat them? Because people often collect medicine. They need a little thyroid or they're on something, Fosamax or Actonel or Beneva for osteoporosis. And we don't necessarily want to add medicine. And what's safe once people at age 55 get a headache? Do we still use the triptans? Like, there are 7 triptans like Imitrax and Ralpax and Maxalt. For the majority of people, I think that these medicines still are safe, unless they have a lot of heart, cardiac risk factors, high cholesterol, horrible family history, diabetes, high blood pressure, particularly high blood pressure that's not well controlled. We try to stay away from the triptans. The problem is if we don't use the Imitrax, Ralpax, Maxalt type of medicine, what do we have? We don't have great alternatives that are all that safe either. The problem is that we talked earlier in the show about drug abuse in boomers age 50 to 60, and some of the alternatives for headaches, if you don't use the non-addicting triptans, a lot of people are given Vicodin or Tylenol with codeine or Furanol with codeine, and prescription drug abuse is a huge problem. Several million people at least, minimum, are prescription drug abusers. So I try to stick with non-addicting, the triptans, et cetera, et cetera. When you do get an occasional headache, Susie, do you still use Imitrax, a triptan?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do still get an occasional headache. Going off the birth control pill has not eliminated them. But I know my triggers, and typically if I have red wine the next morning, I will have a migraine. And yes, I still will take the occasional Imitrex, and it works just as well as it used to. And for that, I feel very, very happy.
Yeah, you know, as we, as many people get into their 50s, we lose the hormonal influence, but the other influences are still there. Red wine and undersleeping and weather changes. So people still need to watch things. I wanted to talk about another subject that came up, and that stems from an interesting article this week on suicide. The article focused on the fact that suicide kills more people in the world every year than war and murder combined. Actually, 20 to 60 million people attempt suicide worldwide every year, and almost a million of them succeed. A million deaths a year to suicide. It's incredible. Now, I have a hard time talking about suicide without talking about the underlying illness, which is usually depression. Not everybody who attempts or commits suicide is depressed or has been depressed. Sometimes it's a spontaneous thing, but the vast majority have had depression, at least recent onset or more often chronic long-standing. Now, interestingly enough, in some countries, it's easier to come forward with depression or suicidal thoughts versus other countries. In some countries, it's actually illegal to commit suicide or to actually have suicidal thoughts, etc. And in those countries, it's much tougher to come forward and get help, leading actually, strangely, to more suicides. In the United States, the dorm room situation in colleges, some colleges have made it a problem for kids who are suicidal or have attempted suicide to stay in the dorms. And I understand from the college's standpoint, from a legal standpoint, it's always tricky. I think that the laws and the legal, the fear of lawsuits colors a lot of what goes on in our country. But there's been a number of articles recently about dorms and colleges rethinking that policy. There actually has been a lawsuit, several lawsuits from people who had a suicide attempt and then were forced out of the dorm or tempted to be. See, for me, taking the devil's advocate legal standpoint, if I was a college and I had a kid who's suicidal in the dorm, there's been lawsuits over suicides that the college didn't do enough. They should have, would have, could have, should have known, should have helped. These days, there's always possible lawsuits. So they want, from my reading of it, is they want the kids out of there and they don't want the legal responsibility. But on the other hand, is that fair? And also, kicking them out of the dorm leads to lawsuits anyways. It just seems to me that policies that make it tougher for people to come forward with suicidal thoughts or with depression are counterproductive. Now, Susie, you're a social worker. What do you think we should do with kids, teenagers, college kids who are depressed or suicidal?
Well, I think above everything else, we need to continue to urge anybody who's feeling depressed or suicidal to come forward to get the help that they need. Bar nothing. But it is very frustrating to think of a kid that who has come forward, who has gotten treatment and help, has gotten healthy again, and wants to move back into the dorm to be told that they can't. I could see where that might push a teen into becoming depressed again.
Absolutely, I agree. On the other hand, then, the dorm has extra responsibilities, and say you take this course, which is not that uncommon. A kid has suicidal thoughts, goes to student counseling, then moves back in, and then at some point commits suicide, which a number of college kids do, tragically. Can they blame the dorm or blame somebody at the dorm? And, you know, these days, every time there is a loss, there is a suicide, there's very frequently a lawsuit. I know as a physician, if patients commit suicide, the family often looks at what doctor is on the bottles that the patient took or didn't take, or were they on an antidepressant or not on one, and frequently there's a lawsuit. So that does color how the colleges look at it too. Now the issue is also, how about, are kids too young for therapy, counseling at school? Susie, what do you think about an 18, 20-year-old who is depressed? What should they do?
Well, I think any kid who at any age who's depressed needs to come forward and see a physician to determine what they need. Do they need medicine? Do they need medicine and or therapy? And certainly, I think any teenage, college-age kid who's just looking for some therapy to get some support, I think it's wonderful.
Now, speaking of medicine, there's the therapy and there's medicine. There has been, and we've talked about this in previous shows, medicine and suicide as far as Prozac-type medicine and suicide. And there is the very rare case of somebody who's not suicidal at all, who goes on antidepressants, who has suicidal thoughts, although they rarely complete it. But the fact is, since 1990, the suicide rate is down significantly because of these drugs. And a number of studies have indicated that the medicines like Prozac greatly reduce the risk of suicide. The risk of suicide with severe depression has been listed as high as 15 to 20%, but I think even 10% is probably a more realistic number, but it's significant. 10% is a whole lot when you're thinking about suicide, which is a very final act. The real tragedy of suicide is not only that somebody lost their life, but they leave a fallout. They leave a lot of guilt. they leave a lot of survivor's problems, and very often the family really can never completely recover. You know, we're talking a lot about younger people with suicide, but when they look at a cross-section of who commits suicide, a lot of times it's older people, older men particularly, who have just lost their job or had financial problems. Financial problems are always up there as a reason for suicide, followed by health problems. I believe that people who are single are a little more likely to than people who are married. Although, interestingly enough, they used to talk about the protective effects of having kids with moms and suicide. And in certain groups of moms, this has been looked at, for instance, with personality disorders, with borderline personality disorder. Moms with kids were actually more likely to commit suicide. So having kids did not really protect them from suicide. Susie, any thoughts?
You know, it comes to my mind when you're mentioning mothers and the fallacy of protection with the children is, how about the moms who decide to take their own lives but take their kids down with them?
Yeah.
What a waste that is.
The suicide, homicide, and fathers also who do it. You know, there's been an interesting couple of books on parents who kill their kids throughout the centuries, and actually a percentage of kids in every culture, in every country, from the time that we have any sort of writings on this at all, thousands of years ago, percentage of kids are killed by their parents. Now, sometimes it's a cultural thing, such as in some cultures killing more girls because they want the boys, which is pretty crazy. And sometimes it depends on the parents. Some of the parents are psychotic, such as just delivering a child and then becoming psychotically depressed in the moms. Sometimes it's a personality disorder thing where the parents just don't care and are so narcissistic and really don't have much caring at all. How about women killing their children versus men? What do you think?
Well, I don't know any specific statistics on it, but if you watch a lot of television and real-life murder mysteries, it certainly seems like it's more women killing their children than fathers.
And, of course, some of those cases are very dramatic. The Yates case, and then the whole question of insanity, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that'll wrap it up for our fourth radio podcast medical show. If you want to talk about any medical subjects, please email us. The email is right on the homepage here, and or you could type it in, Doc Larry Robbins, Doc Larry Robbins at AOL.com. See you next week.